A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to the Friday Special, a podcast by Guitar Nerds. Now for 2020, the Friday Special series will be running every week. And each week I'll have a new guest from the world of guitars, amplification, effects pedals. We're going to have brands, producers, musicians, etc. I'm your host, Joe Branton. Joined by my co-host, Matt Knight.
Hello there.
And this week, the incredible Nick Reinhardt.
Good day.
Good day, Nick. Thank you very much and welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a while since I've seen my guitar nerd friends or spoken.
Yes, absolutely. We did a podcast with you, I don't know, a couple of years ago when we were in Germany together, and obviously Matt, you've done lots of stuff with Nick since then for Boss.
Yeah, it's I sent Nick a couple of pictures the other day when I was going through my hard drives. I had to dig out some pictures from the House of Vans gig, which you both played at, actually.
Oh, yeah, we did both play, yeah.
That's the good thing when you book the gigs, because then you can just book your mates' bands.
I'm wearing a pair of shoes I got from that gig.
I mean, that was
I can't believe
weekend.
Those shoes have still lasted.
That's right, yeah.
Were those the all-black Vans?
You know what's so funny? This is like shoe nerds talk as opposed to guitar nerds talk. They gave me a pair of all-black Vans at that thing, and I was like, I felt so awkward, but I went and found like a manager of the House of Vans, and I was like, I'm so sorry, but could I get a different pair? I don't really do the all black Vans.
I was thinking when you said it, I was like, I am surprised to think of Nick Reinhardt in a pair of black shoes. That doesn't seem nearly primary colored enough.
That's right. So he gave me a pair of blue ones, and the kicker was I gave him the black ones back, and he's like, oh, just hang on to them. So I do have the black ones, and I just started wearing the black ones for the first time this week. Wow. But I'm wearing the blue ones right now.
Wow. Well, I still, you know, it's that's an assault to my reality to think of you in anything other than the primary color, but okay.
So thanks for having me on a Shoe Nerds podcast. I guess that wraps it up.
I think some pairs of shoes now sell for more than some guitars. So actually, maybe we are in just totally the wrong business here.
Probably.
I feel like if we were in some sort of, I mean, this is going back like 6 months. I was in Camden and going past one of those, like to be worn again, like vintage clothes places. They had like a beat up pair of like original like Air Jordans from like the 80s. And they were like £1,500. I'm like, what?
Wow.
It's like a shoe.
Wow.
Crazy.
That is an impressive price. But anyway, talking about, let's talk about some guitar stuff, because we do have Nick Reinhardt on the podcast.
We could start with what shoes are best for stomping on pedals. I guess
I have always wondered this, actually. I've noticed this is incredibly, this is freakishly geeky. But I've noticed that Nick often wears New Balances, which I think have a relatively pointed toe. I've wondered if that is a shoe that especially lends itself to effects pedal tap dancing.
Yeah, I've actually been asked this, believe it or not, a lot, because I've been wearing those shoes. I started finding those shoes. This is so we really are doing shoe merch, which is fine. It's cool. I found like a pair of those shoes in the mid 2000s, somehow like, because we would go to like a lot of thrift stores on tour or whatever, you know, like looking for gear or something. And every once in a while you would magically find, I don't know, a pedal or something. I guess that's more pawn shops. But like, so we were hitting pawn shops and thrift stores a lot. And randomly you could find, there was like almost at every other thrift store, there was a pair of these New Balance shoes that I liked a lot. And they fit me proper, and I just kind of liked the way they looked or whatever. So I just started getting all these like shoes for like, you know, $4, these pairs of New Balance tennis shoes. But they are not good for stomping pedals, and this is why. On the bottom of the shoes, there's like the sole has if you were to look at the bottom of a pair of shoes, it's not flat. It's like there's like tracks on it. Do you know what I mean? There's kind of like these not bumps, but it's shaped in a way, I don't know. Basically what happens is you need to wear all those like grooves down to be flat in order for like to engage pedals properly. Because like, let's say not a Boss pedal, but let's say any pedal with like a classic whatever button, you know, I don't know what you would call that, but you know, like an Earthquaker Devices pedal, you know,
that just style, like a normal stump switch,
that style,
I call that the EHX button.
Exactly, that button. If you're wearing this particular pair of shoes that I wear and you go down and it's they're not worn in enough, like the bottoms haven't like, you know, just worn those bumps and those creases and ridges down, it's a little awkward because you won't, you know, it's not enough to like miss the button, but you can kind of like almost think you triggered it and you didn't, you know what I mean? So basically playing a show in a brand new pair of New Balances can be a little bit difficult for pedal stopping. Is what I'm getting at.
I think that was an incredible bit of information out there.
Yeah, you've heard that here first, pedal stompers. But actually, that kind of actually brings us on to something that I think, you know, I was planning to ease the audience in, but let's go the whole way in. You don't use switches, which is unusual for someone who uses pedal boards of the size that you use pedal boards, but I guess that's because you do such a lot of quick flicking through sounds.
Yeah, and I like it to be kind of an improvised thing. And okay, so this is the way I've always thought about it. One reason you would use like a switcher or some sort of effects loop system would be like, oh, I need this distortion and this delay to turn on at the exact same time, right? Fair? Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
So I've always thought about it like, all right, dang it, on this beat, on this downbeat, all right, I want to turn on this Line 6 FM4 and a chorus pedal at the exact same time, which is like very tricky to do if they're not right next to each other, right? Okay, wow, that would be so much easier if I was using some sort of like switching system. But then I'm like, but wait, I'm going to be able to turn that. If I hit this FM4 and then I hit a chorus right after that, I mean, what are we talking? Like a half a second later? Who's like, is anyone going to notice if the delay pedal does not come on at the exact same time of the distortion pedal or whatever, you know? And in other words, I kind of like weighed out my options. Like, do I really want to like go through this whole process of learning how to assemble a pedal board and like going like, cause that would fully flip things for me to have a switcher. You know,
I guess you figured that the sacrifice was more than the advantage. Because for me, I'm like, yeah, I love the fact if I can use a switcher and I can just hit, you know, I only have to worry about one thing. That means I'm way less likely to mess up what I'm doing with my hands. And so that's the logic there. But for you, I think it's like you view it as being a sacrifice of,
yes,
of the creative, being able to do whatever you want. Because of course, I, you know, by having a switcher, I'm like, here's my clean, here's my drive, here's my modulation tone, here's the ring mod, here's the delay, and that's it. I have those five sounds, that is it. Whereas you can buddy up anything you want. You could have every pedal on, you could have any two combinations, any three combinations.
Exactly.
The amount of combinations you must have, because what are you using at the moment? Three pedal boards? You change your pedal board for every tour, right?
I mean, yeah, that's the thing. It's not quite what I'm using at the moment, because it's not even every tour. Every show that I play, I mean, because even in the last couple of years, I've gotten into this thing where it's like I just play with a lot of people locally, you know, at a jazz bar on a Monday night, or a weird art space doing a solo gig on a Thursday night or something. And every single show format that I play in, I just build a new pedal board for that. So it gets switched up a bit, and or quite a bit, I guess. And it was funny because you used the word, you said, if you have the switcher, you know, you don't have to worry about doing this. And that kind of stuck out to me, because I'm like, oh yeah, thinking about it, I don't really worry about stuff. It's more like I look forward to the section where I get to like start messing with all these sounds and doing the tap dancing thing and turning this on, turning that on. And also having all those options, you know, because it's like a lot of the time it's like a truly improvised process of what I'm turning on, or like, oh, you know, tonight I think I'm going to try this, you know what I mean, like during this section of this song. And so just having it all wide open as far as being able to engage this, you know, or whatever, without a switching system, like you said, I guess sacrifice feels a little dramatic, but yes, it doesn't fully feel worth it for me to like totally you know, flip my entire pedal building world inside out just for a little bit of convenience, which again, when I weigh the amount of convenience I gain from that, it's really not that much. And it's probably just because I've been doing it this way for so long.
I think, I guess there's a tendency sometimes when, you know, and I definitely, you know, I've felt that before. Sometimes it's just really easy to like get a pedal and you find a sound you like, and then you're just like, that's it. I will just never ever like touch those controls. It does that delay sound. And a lot of people do that. But I guess for you, a lot of the pedals that you bring on your boards, you kind of know inside out. Because when I saw you a couple times, maybe the year before last, I think, when you did a UK tour, for both shows, even though like similar sections had similar types of sounds, it was still all improvised. And I guess you're looking at the pedal board almost like another instrument. Because you also used like a Keith McMillan like MIDI controller, right? To like trigger stuff on a drum machine.
Now that's an interesting part of your board. Because that stayed there for a while now.
Yeah. Well, the Keith McMillan, what is it? I think it's a 12 step, because I get the soft step and the 12 step mixed up. I'm looking around my studio right now to see if I can find it. I don't know where it is. yeah, so that controls a Roland SP-404 sampler. That way I can be hands-free at cueing certain samples or sound effects that I want throughout the set. And just as a little factoid about that thing, up until that particular Keith McMillan piece of gear, I think the only way that you could do what I'm describing of triggering a Boss sampler was through the big Behringer MIDI footboard.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know which one I'm talking about?
The one with two, it's got two expression pedals and then eight pedals. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
and it's really big and heavy. And I used to tour with that thing. I used to tour internationally with that thing, and I didn't have a case for it. So I just had this like cardboard box that I like kind of shaped into a case for it. And then I would tape the cardboard box to like a pedal case. And it was this big nightmare to do that. And the other thing with the Roland, the Behringer, was you had to, in order to get the MIDI to communicate with I think at the time I was maybe using an SP-303, but maybe it was a 404, but to get it to communicate with the sampler, you had to like fully hack the Behringer. You had to modify it. I think you had to add some sort of chip to it, and then you had to download this insanely archaic software that looked like when you opened it up, it looked like some like like it was from 1992 or something like that.
Yes.
You had to use the software and then totally like link it all up. It was a process. In fact, I took it over to a friend's house that was like a computer nerd, because I'm like, I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. So I brought it to his house. And then I remember playing Russia one, like our very first show in Russia or whatever. And like everyone's, you know, we get there and we're nervous and we're like, oh my God, this is insane. I can't believe we're in Russia. We're doing the thing where like we land, go straight to the venue and plug everything in. And I plugged that Russian, or I keep, not the Russian, the Behringer into some sort of Russian power converter thing, and it blew it up immediately. So I was like, great, there goes my Behringer. Rest of the tour I couldn't use it. And then it's like I get home, have to buy another Behringer massive footboard, bring it to the friend's house again, schedule time to go to the friend's house, have him hack it and update it again, blah blah blah, use it for a little while longer. And then I think someone from Keith McMillan contacted me and was like, hey, I think we have something that you could use to replace that. And I was like, oh my God, please tell me you have something to replace this. Wow, it worked. There was a little bit of like nerdy computer stuff that I had to do, but I was able to figure it out. But someone DM'd me about this recently, like, hey, I've got that Keith McMillan thing, how do you do it? And I'm like, man, I don't remember, but it was definitely like I gave myself a full day of just sitting down in my studio being like, all right, I'm gonna figure out how to do this. Like it's not as simple as just plugging in a MIDI controller into a sampler and boom, it works, you know what I mean? There's like certain things you have to do. So but yeah, the moral of that story is it works. It's badass, and I love having that option now. And the 12-step Keith McMillan thing is so tiny; it could fit in anything. It's pliable. You could throw it off of, you know, a bridge, and it'll still work. And blah blah blah.
You mount it on the front of a sort of two or three tier board as well, which is fantastic because it can work in that capacity.
Yeah, that's what I was doing. I'm trying to recall what the last, again, you know, because it switches my pedal board is different every tour, right?
Yeah, of course. Admittedly, I'm probably going from when we played together, which is 2 years ago.
Correct. So I yes. probably would have somehow incorporated it into the actual, like, you know, had it velcroed to the board or something and had it all wired properly. But yeah, I guess, yeah, the moral of all that is I love building things. I really enjoy, Matt, you mentioned something about when we were talking about the physical nature of the pedal board and all that. And it's like, I really, I enjoy playing the pedal board as much as I enjoy playing the guitar. So like to have those types of shortcuts of like, oh, a switcher. So again, Joe, so I don't have to quote unquote worry about this. I'm like, well, I really, for the, at least the world that I'm in of playing guitar, the pedal board is like an extension of the guitar and my brain, you know what I mean? So like, I'm not trying to like, I look forward to those moments of like, ooh, here we go. Here comes a fun part where I'm not only playing guitar, but I'm playing the pedal board, you know?
Man, that's such a wonderful way to view it. Because you're totally right. And I can completely see, the limitations of a switcher. So, of course,
you know what? You know what? Maybe the analog to that would be like, you know, some people really enjoy driving a stick shift on their car. And I'm like, why the heck would you want to drive stick shift when you can have an automatic? You know what I mean? I'm like, my car drives automatic and I don't have to think about it. But there's some freaks out there that are like, ooh, I love shifting gears.
Well, you know, we pretty much don't have automatics.
There you go. There you go. So imagine I'm like, wait, you guys don't have automatics? Don't you want to just like not have to worry about shifting when you're driving?
I don't know why we don't. I'm sure there's some incredibly macho reason.
I'm sure. I was gonna say then we should probably, just in case anyone's sort of listening and going, wow, I want to know what bands Nick plays in if they don't actually already know. So I guess we should probably talk about Terramellos for a little bit and kind of, because I want to talk about. We were just talking about the pedals and playing pedal boards. I remember seeing a video from you recording the solo for, I want to say, Warpless Run,
yes,
in the studio, yes, which was like all improvised, right? So I'm guessing you, do you kind of go into solos or bits of tracks knowing what you want to do, or?
I know exactly what video you are talking about, from the Terram Ellis record, Trash Generator song, Warpless Run. There's like a completely wild, out of control guitar solo. And I mean, I think the concept was, let me build a pedal board right now, you know, like let me string together, I don't know, 10 pedals or something, and let me do a few passes at the solo of just like losing my mind to it. There was no rhyme or reason to it. The only thing I was trying to avoid, at that tempo, it's a very fast, like punk tempo. My instinct was to have play the solo, not that I could play the solo, but at least imitate the solo from Pantera Suicide Note Part 2, which is this crazy, like, whammy, pitch shifted, gnarly solo. And I just wanted to keep going into like that solo. It had that energy. So I'm like, all right, no Suicide Note Part 2 solo, but something in that like level of wackiness. And I think mine's probably a little bit stranger and more oddball than that one, but yeah, so there was that was just completely improvised, and I think I did a few different passes at it, and then maybe we like, hey, that first take, all of this was cool, what about this like funny little messed up flanger sound you did in the third take? All right, we'll just kind of drop that in there, and there you go, that's it.
So with that then, I guess let's, I you know, I kind of want to know a little bit about, and I'm sure some other people do, I mean, just like, I know there's other videos of you talking about your kind of, I think you did one with Reverb before, talking about your sort of first pedals and that, but what was sort of like the scene like where you were when Terram Ellis first started, and did you have an idea of, you know, what sort of music you were going to do? I mean, obviously listening to like the early records, you know, some of the tracks are just so out there, especially considering what else was going on around that sort of time.
Yeah, well, so Terram Ellis is my band that we started, I think, in 2004. I had been playing punk music before that, and then that, like, we were in, the bass player, Nathan, and I were in this punk band, and we just kind of stopped being a band, and he and I were like, all right, well, let's start a new band. We're 23 or whatever. Like, we got time. Let's start a new thing. Okay, cool. So we started this band, and it was like a little, he and I had started writing music together that was a little different than just straightforward punk stuff, but it still had like the punk spirit to it. And we were like really into, like, you know, bands like Fugazi, which had kind of like taken us away from being just straightforward punk bands. And then this band appears out of nowhere in Northern California called Hella, which, you know, is Zach Hill and Spencer Sine, these two, yeah, just insane musicians. And like, you know, at the time we weren't aware of like what quote unquote math rock was. We, like I said, we were punk dudes, and all of a sudden here's this band that pops up that we start seeing, and we're like, whoa, what is this? And then right around that same time, we had heard, I guess this is 2001. So in 2001, we're, you know, doing the punk thing. Hella pops up. Oh, and then we're super into Fugazi. And then we hear this band Dillinger Escape Plan, and kind of like start, all these like different influences start kind of like seeping into like the guitar riffs I was playing and stuff. So then punk bands, blah, 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 break up. We start this new thing, and we're like, well, why don't we kind of try our version of what all this stuff is that's like really exciting to us. And so that's Terram Ellis, which, by the way, as a little side note, I was giving a guitar lesson the other day via Skype, and someone was asking me about a tapping riff off the first record, and kind of like referencing like, oh, so
what was the first record, Alive?
That's an EP. There's like a so funny, a quote-unquote EP. It was like a really bad live recording from a local show we had played that we just made CDs and like at like Kinko's and sold. I mean, we, yeah, maybe sold like 50 of those that exist.
Really? Because, you know, I have one of those CDs. Oh, that's
pretty
incredibly
crazy.
Incredibly geeky.
That's
I
amazing.
Bought it off of eBay like years ago.
That's amazing. Yeah. Like, I don't even know if I have one of those. That's crazy.
That's really embarrassing.
There's literally probably less than 100 of those that exist, I think. I can't imagine we made more than 100. But then our first record was this record. It didn't have a name, so it just kind of is known as Untitled. But it's not called Untitled. It is just not titled. And so someone, I was teaching someone, someone asked me about a tapping riff off that first record. And maybe the other day they were like, oh yeah, like were you into this band or this band? And you know, like a lot of people around that era were like, whoa, this band must be like really into Don Caballero. And not true. Like even to this day, I love Battles, but I've never listened to a Don Caballero record. Not for any particular reason, just because I haven't gotten around to listening to it. I know I've heard a song because I've heard a song, you know, at a venue before a show, and I'm like, whoa, what's this? Then I Shazammed it or something. It turned out it was Don Caballero. But in those early days, I was not listening to Don Caballero. Like I said, it was Hella or Dillinger's Escape Plan or Fugazi or this one particular guitar riff that I was teaching this guy. I was like, nope, wasn't listening to that. I specifically remember this was my version of a Primus riff. I was super into, like, Primus would have been one of the very first bands I heard doing the tapping, like wild tapping thing, you know, DMV or Jerry Was a Race Car Driver or something. And so I love that sound. And so I kind of figured out how to do that on guitar. And that's kind of like where some of that early stuff came from. But yeah, in terms of like sonically with effects and pedals and stuff, the very beginning of the band was like not a lot of pedals. It was just kind of like what we had left over from our previous bands, you know? But yeah, the one kind of gateway for me that was like, whoa, a pedal can do this, was the Digitech Synthwah.
Oh, of course. What a fantastic pedal to be your gateway into, you know, becoming, you know, as you are now known, the Willy Wonka of guitar pedals.
And someone gave me that, my friend Patrick Hills, the guy who's made a bunch of records for my bands and played with us and stuff. He gave me his Digitech Synthwah because he's like, again, Think about the context. Punk rock dudes just playing fast, like skate hardcore punk stuff. This dude, like one of our friends, ends up with this Digitech Synthwah, and he's like, "What am I supposed to do with this?" You know, and it's like, well, you know, Nick's starting this new band that's like a little different. I don't know, maybe he'd want it. So he gave me that pedal, and you know, it does like those weird growly kind of like whatever format sounds, you know, like the different vowel things. And you know, I that was my first one. I'm like, whoa, cool,
it's absolutely fantastic pedal. You can pick it up for virtually no money as well. Totally. I mean, I don't know what it goes for in the States. Like, you can pick it up for about 30 quid.
I was gonna say,
you say that now, you definitely can't anymore.
I
think they're discontinued, or maybe the base one is, but one of them is incredibly hard to get hold of, and they're creeping up to like, I guess, what would be the equivalent of like $100.
Oh my goodness.
So
my saxophone player goes through one of those. that's true.
Yeah, it's a really neat pedal, and I was gonna say 40 or 50 bucks, but yeah, maybe they're a little more now. In fact, I only ever had one, and it broke maybe, I don't know, 6 years ago or something, so I actually haven't replaced it. But yeah, that was my very first pedal that made me go, huh, okay, that's kind of cool, and that does neat things, so let's see what else I can get my hands on.
So fast forward to now, from then, funnily enough, if the first pedal that got you into pedals was a synth pedal, you've become quite synonymous with using the Meris Enzo, which is their synth pedal.
Yes.
And that is a far cry from the Digitech.
Yeah. I remember Meris contacted Juan and myself about doing their kind of campaign for that pedal when they released it. Like, hey,
because you ran that on pedalsandeffects.com. That was the big launch for Meris, really.
Yeah, we did. And I still, I mean, whatever, a year or two later, still have people like writing me like, hey, what, how do I do this with that pedal, or what do you recommend? Would you take this or whatever? And like, yeah, I love talking about it. I mean, it's a great pedal. You know, it's so interesting, the different like formats that all these builders use for this stuff, you know what I mean? And like, I just think it's really fun to have the different varieties, the different like nuances of sounds within each one. And so that's why, where like the collector mentality comes in, like, ooh, this is cool. Like, I want to have lots of synth pedals for lots of different options. And just that, you know, kind of sound in general, I'm just, has been, I guess, since that Digitech synth wah, just making your turning your guitar into a new instrument. You know what I mean? Like that sounds like literally some sort of synthesizer or like a Casio that you would get at a thrift store for $15 or something. Like there's just all these all these pedals now that without any sort of like crazy cables or whatever, just a regular quarter inch. I still don't understand how you're able to like process a guitar signal that way, but somehow you can do it, you know.
Some things are probably best left unturned. I think probably if you knew it would ruin the magic. And right. then, but because I know you've got a couple, right? XP300 space stations.
Yeah, I'm looking at two of them. I just sold. I had three and I sold one recently. I'm like, I don't need.
They're going for so much money now.
That's a tricky pedal, right? Because the gold one, the proper space station, that's a really expensive pedal. And I have one. I finally got one last year because I think on average, you can probably get one of those for like $400 US. Yeah. Like that's about maybe like, that would be considered a pretty average deal. I think I found a dude selling it. Man, I'd have to go back and look at the email. I feel like I got mine for like $150, which I was just like, cool. I already have one of these, not the proper real one. I had a modified modulation XP series, whatever number that was. But I was like, whatever. It's cool to have the real one and it's so inexpensive. I'm just going to get this. So at the time I had two modded ones and a real one, to which, like I said, I sold one of the modded ones recently.
Well, the real kicker for me, when I first moved away from home and I went to go and live in Brighton to go to music college, one of the teachers there was Ace from Skunk and Anansie, who I was a massive fan of because he wrote an effects column in Guitarist magazine, which was part of the reason I got really into effects, more so than really just playing guitar. And he lent me a bunch of stuff, one of which was, he was like, oh, I'm just getting rid of all this stuff that I haven't used for years, was an XP300, which I wasn't even on anyone's radar really at that point. And I think he wanted like £70 for it or something like that. And I was a student, I had no money. So I was like, I can't afford it. And then I ended up buying one of those modded ones. I think it's like the jetpack mod. You can go between all four. And I just wasn't using it. I mean, I think I sold it like 5 years ago. And now I'm just like, man, they come up like once every 6 months.
What year around was it when he offered it to you for
It must have been 2006, maybe 2007.
Okay. So then I have a funny addition to that story. So the same guy, Patrick, that gave me the Digitech synth wah had been given the space station. What is the number? What is the number of the gold one?
XP300.
The 300. He had been given a 300 by another one of our friends that was in kind of that punk world, right? And Patrick disassembled it and used it for pieces. For other pedals, swear to God. And because, again, this was the same guy that gave me the Digitech synth wah, because it was like, what are you supposed to do with this thing? You know, just like, these sounds don't interest me. And of course, now, like, we've joked about it for years now, like, dude, you straight up, like, took apart and, like, just trashed your XP300 for the pieces, which is just insane.
I guess, one of the things I've picked up on, which I would say is, to me, always sounds like a signature of one of your sounds, is the kind of Aphex Twin square pusher, like square wave synth sound out of the FM4. So at what point did like the FM4 and the DL4, because obviously you were lucky enough to be recognized, I guess, as one of the major DL4 users, because you've got one of the anniversary ones, I think they made for like the 23rd.
I do.
So when did those pedals sort of like hit the radar, and how game changing were they for you at that point?
So in 2004, Taramellis made our first record, and the other guitar player, Jeff Worms, he had a DL4 at the time, the big green expensive one that I was like, whoa, no, I'm good on that.
So they were expensive.
What's that?
I said they were really expensive. Me and Joe were talking about it on another podcast a few weeks ago when I bought an FM4, and yeah, they were
crazy. Think about
expensive.
Like $250 for a pedal. That's still expensive, by the way. It's rare that I spend that much money on a pedal unless I'm like, I gotta have this, you know, but I'm just like, I respect anyone that's willing to spend that much money on a pedal. And I know that's like, that's not a lot of money these days. You know what I mean? If you want like a cool boutique pedal, like I know, like, you know, you can get an Earthquaker Devices Plumes overdrive, which is like my favorite overdrive, for $100, which that's awesome. But I get it that that's not the reality of most pedals, you know? But back then it was like, you know, kids with crappy jobs trying to like spend their own money to like save money to make a record or go on tour or buy a van, you know, like the idea of spending $250 on a pedal just was crazy to me. So, but our other guitar player somehow, you know what? I know how he got his. He worked at a local shop, used music shop called Music Around. And he had this funny trick he would do where, you know, he'd be working by himself, you know, on a Tuesday afternoon or something. And a guy would come in with all this gear and Jeff would be like, "Hey, look, you know, the store, let's see. So you have this old 1940s Gibson acoustic or something. And like, I'm going to be real with you. The store can only give you $300 for this, but I'll give you $350 cash right now, like under the table deal. And, you know, Grandpa Joe, that doesn't know any better, that Gibson is really worth $1,300 or whatever, takes Jeff's silly offer of $350 and then it's off the books and no one ever knows. So Jeff got all this crazy gear through this funny little scam he had at this music shop of just like totally like, you know, doing this under the table deals. And that's probably how he got the deal for at the time.
So Jeff, thanks for listening. If you could just, you know, pack your suitcase, you need to get out of the house because the police are coming.
Yeah, you're out of here, dude. So he had that deal for, and I thought it was cool, you know, like, okay, that's neat. It does looping and does all the, you know, delay sounds. And at the time, you know, it's like the first Mars Volta record is out and he's doing that analog delay, oscillating feedback sound, which became synonymous with like the mid 2000s, which I'm so over that sound now, but at the time it was a really big deal. And
wait,
and
you're over that sound?
Oh no, thank you.
I'm never getting over that sound.
I just heard it, so I had to listen to that those first two freaking Mars Volta records so many times in the van on our early tours, and I'm like, I can't ever do this again. But Jeff had that the DL4, which we have on our first record. I'm not using it on the first record. Jeff did. And then it was so funny because then by 2006, Jeff leaves the band and I'm like, all right, I want more pedals now because it's a sync, you know, it's a three piece and I only one guitar player. So I need to like fill up some more sonic room. So I did eventually get a DL4, probably found one used. I don't think I've ever bought a new DL4, but I probably found
You've
a used one.
So many DL4s.
I know. Well, it's that pedal's the kind of thing where even though I'm looking at five right now, and I think...
You paint them as well, don't you?
I do,
just for listeners who don't know.
I think I have five, and two of them are working at the moment. No, three. Three of them are working. Three out of five work at the moment. Right. But that's the kind of pedal where it's like, if I see one on Craigslist or anywhere for a reasonable deal, I'm like, I'll take it. I'll take another one. Like, for instance, if I looked on Craigslist right now, and I mean, this would not happen, but let's say there was one for $75, I would just buy it for $75, a broken one. I'd buy a broken DL4 for $75 and go get it fixed, you know, just to have them because they're cool to have. And then also, you know, the neat thing about collecting pedals, which this has like been happening to me since I was kind of thrust into this world, is like you get doubles and triples of something. And then turns out your friend needs one, or someone asks you, "Hey, what's a really cool looper that I can use?" And I'm like, "Well, actually, as a matter of fact, I happen to have one. So here, what's your address? Let me send this to you." You know what I mean? Like, so that's like a fun thing, like, you know, having, you know, multiples of pedals. But I do want to say that purple pedal, the FM4, that was like the elusive pedal for us for a long time. And I did not have one of those, I think, until I was really cranky about spending the money on that pedal. Nope, I'm not spending $200 on that freaking pedal. Like, and I know it's cool. Like at that time, the Locust, it's like, oh yeah, Locust, they use the purple pedal, like the big line, you know, purple line six pedal, and they get all these cool bug, insane synth sounds out of it. But I was just so snotty about like spending that much money on one. So I really didn't get an FM4, I think, until, geez, I'm trying to think back. I eventually found a used one, I think for $100, which probably that's what the going rate on them is now. But I definitely didn't get an FM4. I'm looking at it right now on my shelf. That's my original one. Maybe, I don't know, maybe in the late 2000s, I got one and then started messing with it. And then, yes, there's that kind of square wavy, filtery sound that I love, that really kind of deep kind of, synth swell thing. I don't even know. It's so funny. It's like my favorite sound. I don't even fully know how to describe what it is. Square wave with some filtering on it. That's one of, you know, my favorite sounds out of there. And like a lot of my pedal obsession and sounds and doing all that stuff with the guitar comes from, you know, music made on synth devices or computers, yeah, or whatever, electronic based music. And I also,
that very much does seem to be the sort of case with you. Like, so much of your stuff seems to be influenced by synth, but you managed to add a sort of I don't know what the word is, I can't think of the word, a less than perfectly tonal version. Like a synthesizer, a keyboard is a very exact thing, and you managed to add this messiness to it, which I guess you can't do unless you're using a guitar,
right? And like in a rock band format, right? It's like you're taking those sounds, and we're not playing to a click, and so usually, you know, you're absolutely right. If you're a DJ or something, and you're playing a set or whatever, or an electronic musician, you're like, a lot of times you're on a computer, right? That has like, you know, you're playing to a click and you're doing all this stuff, where it's like, I really like the idea of taking all of the sounds you can produce in that context and putting it into a live rock band format where there's no click track, you know, there's just like, yeah, I'm physically creating those sounds starting with a guitar. You know, and that was always really interesting to me. And that's also where having the big pedal board comes from, is like, ooh, I like to, it's kind of like I'm live mixing, just like, you know, a square pusher live set might be, you know, where he's like, who knows what's going on in front of his face with all of his knobs and software and, you know, hardware pieces. And it's like, well, if you have like a, you know, thousands of these different things you can do, you know, at your fingertips, I was like, well, it'd be really cool if I had, you know, whatever, 35 pedals in front of me, so I could kind of live mix these rock band format songs. And that's kind of what the band evolved to, at least from my perspective, from playing guitar in the band, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So obviously you said, and you know, obviously before the current global situation where everyone couldn't play any gigs anymore, obviously you were saying before we started off, and you know, during the, you know, you're doing a load of sort of random gigs. We've seen a bunch on Instagram as well, like you say, just like an art show or, you know, a jazz club or something. Is there anything that you like always take? I mean, guessing you normally take a DL4 because you use it for looping, but is there anything at the moment you're just like, I always have to take that?
You know, I have recently always been taking my what is it? My Roland GR30 synth guitar.
You don't have to say that because Matt's here.
I know.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do
not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, I know. But, you know, what's so funny is like, so, yeah, I bought this thing, this funny GK pickup that, and I installed it on a guitar maybe, oh, geez, maybe 7 years ago. And I just thought, oh, yeah, cool, funny, like crappy, like saxophone sounds or whatever, like that you associate with like 80s synth sax or whatever.
And what else would you want?
Right? Yeah. I'm like, that's exactly what I want, is a crappy, like, synthetic sax sound. But, yeah, I don't want to say that I've started to feel like I almost use that as a crutch. I don't actually think of it that way. I'm just like, ooh, I'm starting to feel really comfortable in live, let's say improvised settings, when it's like, because that's what a lot of these things that I end up playing are like, have been kind of largely improvised. So I'm like, man, this GR30 kind of synth guitar system is so cool in that context. And I almost started to feel like, oh, these are improvised pieces that we're doing here, and I'm almost so comfortable using this piece of equipment, the music I produce with it starts to feel less improvised, which that's not true. That's all in my head. I guess that's what I'm getting at. But fully, that I bring that and a DL4 to almost every one of these like kind of random one-off things that I play.
That's interesting, because I mean, I think you are, and I probably mentioned this last time that I had you on a podcast, but that was years ago. I can't remember, but you probably are the man that made the Rainbow Machine popular as well. And and of course, you've even played in bands with Jamie Stillman, the fella behind Earthquaker Devices.
We have jammed. I think we have jammed before.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yes, I've heard about the jams. Yeah, that's not quite played in a band. Sorry, that was probably overstating it. But yes, you certainly have jammed with Jamie Stillman on drums, because he's a drummer first.
Yeah,
but
yes.
A fantastically interesting, atmospheric guitarist as well.
Yes.
I've seen him do some fantastic things with his, you know, with his board of Earthquaker Devices pedals.
Yeah, that Rainbow Machine. I'm looking at two of them, two very used, well loved Rainbow Machines on my shelf right now. Great pedal, lots of cool things to get out of it. It's, I mean, my kind of rap about that pedal, anytime it gets brought up, and I don't, this isn't like a canned response. It's just, it's true that like anytime
you use it for a chorus effect,
I use it for a chorus effect. Yes, that's part of the response. But the second half is like, you know, and beyond that, that's a really fun pedal to discover new sounds with. And for instance, having that kind of just smack dab in the middle of your pedal board and being able to like experiment with, you know, different sound, like, you know, different pedal combinations with that pedal. And, you know, just by barely tweaking knobs on that thing, you get new sounds. You get a slapback delay. You get an out of tune slapback delay. You get, you know, like all this weird pitch shifting stuff. And then that's before you're even using the quote unquote magic button, you know? So that's truly like one of the most versatile like pedals I can think of in recent years. That's not like a full on like synth multi-effect kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I guess, you know, with all that sort of pedals and everything and talking about gigs, I kind of want to talk a little bit about Disheveled Cuss, which is obviously your sort of new project, which is I think when you sort of first announced it, you said like this is what people are calling like your normal band, or like
that's what I was calling it that, and my friends were like, stop calling it that.
Because it is very different from obviously the stuff you've done before. I mean, how did you kind of approach that from like a guitar point of view? Because I guess you didn't want to do, I guess you had a bunch of songs that maybe weren't mad enough for Terra Mellos, was that it? Or
yeah, okay, so here's my spiel on this. I think we designed Terra Mellos to be whatever we wanted it to be. Even the name itself, I even think about this, and maybe this was like a bad decision, but like even the name itself is just like, you know, doesn't like make sense to just say it. People say it wrong all the time. Like people don't know what it means. Like sometimes I forget what it means, you know. It's like not, they're not normal words. So like even from day one, we were like, let's make this band just kind of a weird band where we just do whatever we want to do. And in the early days, you know, it was us playing this kind of like proggy, spazzy music. And we were like, you know, cartwheeling, jumping off shit, breaking things. And it was this wacky band, you know. And then it kind of evolved to like, oh, now that's the band that like, you know, has this crazy kind of jazzy drummer that's super into Zach Hill. And then they have all these like pedals at the same time. So they're doing this weird proggy, like pedal freak out songs, you know? And so the band constantly evolved. But one element that it always had is like kind of this freak show element, to where it's like, okay, if we're playing to a room full of people, whether or not anyone likes the band, has ever heard the band, dislikes the band, whatever, one thing that it always had was like this freak show thing. Like, what are these guys doing? This is so weird. Like, I don't know if I like this or not, but like, all right, they're doing something, you know, which I always thought was like a really cool piece of that band. And recently, yeah, I listen to other music. In fact, I don't even really listen to that kind of music all that much, you know. I really like the Beach Boys and Sonic Youth and, you know, Teenage Fan Club and, you know, and electronic music and stuff. And whatever art Terra Mellos is, that's not like, I love playing that music. And I did love listening to that kind of music when I was a kid. But, you know, like you evolve and you know, get into other things. So I've always had this other piece of my musical personality that I did not feel had been properly represented for 15 years, you know? And I tried, like, I would sneak in, right, like, quote unquote, normal things into Terra Mellos songs and melody and choruses and stuff. And we were always able to, I think, kind of like morph these really simple ideas into things that worked in the context of that band. But then, you know, at some point I was like, okay, I would really like to dedicate a proper project band to this sound, these songs that I have in my head, some of which go back to 2000, you know, six. I have guitar riffs in this band, Disheveled Cuss, that go back that far. So when, you know, think back to, if you're familiar, the Terra Mellos era, Drugs to the Dear Youth, you know, like I'm playing normal guitar at home, sitting on my bed, strumming an acoustic guitar, you know, doing some quote unquote normal things during that era. And so fast forward, you know, 15 years, and I'm like, all right, let me do this. And so I decided to finish this record that I'd kind of been piecing together, and I called it Disheveled Cuss. And I guess the way that I've kind of described it is like, there is no freak show quality to this band. It's songs, you know, it's like, all right, here are some songs I wrote. Hope you like them. There's nothing to lean on. There's no like crazy drums. There's no insane wild guitar. It's just me playing songs. And of course, I can't help but filter normal songs through my version of what a normal song would be, you know? So that's why my friend was probably joking with me, like, you got to stop calling them normal songs because they're not fully normal. They're still me doing, it's my version of what a normal song would be, you know?
Yeah.
But it's funny, and not to, I'm not trying to plug my guitar lessons, but to reference that again,
plug them.
Well, to reference these guitar lessons, I don't even know if I want to plug them. I honestly don't love giving guitar lessons. I'm just doing them at the moment. I'm having a good time doing it. I don't mean it that way. I just, you know, it's instilling the knowledge. If people come to me wanting my knowledge and what my approach to guitar is, that is amazing. I could have never imagined that in a million years that someone would want my advice on being in a band, playing guitar, amps, guitars, pedals. You know, that's really cool. And I do enjoy doing it, but I'm like, ooh, yeah, it's, you know, it's tricky to,
I mean, no one really plays guitar like you. You are one of the very few people who has managed to carve out for themselves a very unique style in this sort of modern age of playing guitar. So it's no wonder that there are people who want to learn. But yes, it's,
that's very sweet of you. Thank you.
No. But what a weird thing to have to teach, because so much of your stuff feels like it comes from
it comes from within. Like I think you put up like an Instagram video the other day of a riff that you'd said you'd had for ages and never fit it into a record or something, and I was just watching it going, I just wouldn't even know where to start. I mean, I you know, I'm an average guitar player at best, and I'm never someone to like learn from just watching, but I was like, yeah, I could probably like figure out this Weezer song because, you know, there's some good chords in it. You know, forget the solo, I'm never going to learn that by ear. But it's like watching that, I'm like, that's just no way.
Yeah, well, you know what? The thing that I've realized that I kind of come back to a lot in chatting with people and doing these guitar lesson things is like trying to show them how to break outside of the box they're playing within. And, you know, like I've got a, like maybe a person or two who's like, well, check this thing out that I wrote. And it's like a lot of seventh chords and they're all perfectly matching, you know, very melodic, perfect sounding like riffs that include all these like luscious chords of seventh sounding things. Like that's a thing. I think a lot of people gravitate, young people gravitate towards major seventh chords, which that's what I was doing in when I was 22. I was like, oh yeah, I discover how to play these kind of like, whoa, I go from punk music to playing like these kind of quote unquote jazzy sounding chords. And then you sort of like build yourself into this box, which that's what I felt I did with like our first two recordings. I'm like, whoa, yeah, I felt very comfortable in that world. And so kind of what I end up always going back to with these lessons is like, now that's too good sounding. Make that sound. Let's figure out a way to like make that not sound right. You know what I mean?
That is perfectly put.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And then we're like, well, that doesn't sound right, but how do we make that not right thing sound good? You know? And then like, so it's all about breaking people out of their box. You know, that's the way I've found I can talk and teach people about what my approach is. And it's funny to bring this back to the disheveled cuss thing. I tell everyone, look, Taramellos was never meant to fit inside a box. And maybe that was like why the band has never like, you know, gotten what's bigger or whatever. It's always been like our own little thing. And like those who know about the band, and that's awesome. And I think maybe a few years ago, we kind of acknowledged that like, cool, that's where that's what the life and the career arc of this band will be. It'll be like, if you're in the know, cool. And it'll reach a little bit beyond that, but not a lot. Now with Disheveled Cuss, I wanted to put it in a box. That's the thing with this. I was like, man, I've been like working outside the box for 15 years. I would like to live a little bit inside the box and see what that feels like for a while. And honestly, that's one of the most challenging things I've done. And one of it's really like refreshing and satisfying to be like, ah, man, I don't got to worry. Okay, going back to the Joe Branton thing. I'm not worrying about pedal stuff. I'm not like, I'm really just like up here playing these songs, having a good time and like enjoying playing rock music, you know? And so for me to perform songs like that, to have written them and recorded them in a way that is I thought sounded good. That was like a big challenge to me. And that's what's been like really fun and exciting for me, honestly, is doing that. Now, that's not to say that I get the same feeling playing those types of songs as I do something like either playing a Taramello set or playing an improv set with Greg Saunier from Deerhoof or something, or Zach Hill or whatever. Like, all these different iterations of things provide different things for me to get out of playing music, you know, and being inside a box is definitely not the same thing as any of those other things, but it's a new, it's something new for me. And that was important to me, you know?
Of course. And we haven't even mentioned like Big Warner's Yonder or indeed, everything else that you've done outside of that.
There's a lot. I know it's getting up there. A lot of things.
Yeah, well, like death, at the same time, death grips, I think, is a big thing as well. I appreciate you only came on for you just did the one record with Death Grips, but
let me think here. I think technically my guitar sounds have appeared on 3 Death Grips records, but that's kind of a stretch because it's really 2, and then I think I have like one thing on an EP they did. So we'll say 2.5.
Right.
But I'm not going to hold that against you because it's hard for me to even keep up with like all this stuff, you know.
And I guess the other one that sort of came out the same time as maybe a little bit of Shovel Cusp was Acid Fab, right? Which is your sort of electronica collection of electronica projects that have sort of been...
Yeah, well,
you know, building up.
A cup are the Taramello's bass player Nathan. He lives in Switzerland, and he's got a whole world going on out there. And so, when after that House of Vans UK show, I can't remember. Man, my memory is not great when it comes to dates and stuff. But right around that time, we did a Japanese tour. I can't remember if it was before or after that, but it was right around that time. So that was that 3 years ago?
I think it was after because you went to the...
Oh, good Lord. Was that 3 years ago?
It was 2017 because I went to...
I hate myself.
Because I went to Japan not long after that, and I think you went there, right, as well? I think you went to the... Did you go to the museum
as
well?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. We went into the isolation chamber at Roland, and we did that whole thing. You weren't there at the time, right? You had just
left.
No,
I wasn't. I think I just left. Yeah, I think it was December. It was like Christmas time 2017,
yes.
I think,
okay.
Wasn't it?
So that was the last time that Taramello's was like active, like properly active. And then fast forward, we did a little bit. We toured in 2019, or was that 2018? Oh, my God.
I think it was 2018. That was where 2018.
No, you did tour. Taramello's toured 2019.
The definitely. Minus the Bear tour, the final Minus the Bear tour, whenever that was. That was... a year and a half ago. That was two Novembers ago. And that was, we had a fill-in bass player, our friend Patrick, the guy, the Digitech Synthwah and XP300 guy. He played bass with us on that tour. And what I'm getting at is, because Nathan was just kind of had his hands full in Switzerland, and we do this tour and we have someone fill in, and it's like, man, we don't want to do this band without like one of the original members. So, okay, this band's going to be a little slow for a while. And okay, well, like I got to get other things going because, you know, I need to be active playing music and writing and creating. So I finished the Disheveled Cuss record, and simultaneously I was like, you know what would be really cool is to like really try and complete some of these like electronic based, like properly electronic based songs that I had been doing. And I got offered to open a Melt Banana tour, which would be happening in 1 month from now, which I do not believe is happening anymore, clearly.
Really? Why not?
Yeah. So I was supposed to go. I got offered to open for Melt Banana solo, and I'm like, ooh, okay, I wonder what I'm going to do. I could do it as an improvised thing. That would be easy. But then I thought, well, this would be a really good opportunity to shore up all these electronic bits and pieces that I have. So that through that, I created this new project, Acid Fab, which I would say is like – fully just like committed to the electronic portion of things that I do. And I put out an EP. It's an 12 minute song or something that's sort of like a preview of what a completed record might resemble. And I made a music video for that too.
Amazing.
Trying to stay busy, man. It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we are all obviously locked at home. It makes sense to stay busy. Mm-hmm. Now, this is really late in the podcast to ask this, but I it would be wonderful to move out of pedals and into guitars, because
sure,
guitars are also an incredibly interesting thing for you. You've been a massive advocate of the Squire Vista series. This has actually been something that even fans have helped you out with in the past.
Yeah.
But the what is the name of the model again? The Squire,
Supersonic. The Squire Supersonic.
Which is the Vista series, which is Korean?
CIJ, Korean? Crafted in Japan.
Oh, it's Japanese. Damn.
Well,
I didn't even realize that.
Well, the bass out of the Vista series, that is not Japanese. That may have been...
No, that's why I think, because I own one of those, which is the Music Master.
Yes,
And that is Chinese.
Yes, that was the Chinese instrument out of the bunch. But I believe, I don't actually own, well, I have, what's it called? The Venus, the Courtney Love Venus.
Well, that's another thing I was going to talk about. You, of course, own the Venus, which is incredible.
That's a Japanese guitar. And then I have all the different colors of the Supersonics, and those are all crafted in
Japan.
You
have all the different colors.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
How recently did you get all the different colors?
Because I got the White Whale happened to be the white Supersonic. That seemed to be the rarest one for me to come by. Could never find one of those, and a dude in Canada had found me somehow and knew that I was looking for one off of a forum or something, and this was like, he's the only other person I've ever known that was like a Supersonic psycho. This guy had 11 Supersonics, and he wanted to help me finish my collection, so he sold it to me.
For listeners, can you explain what the Supersonic is? And also, I guess your first one was the blue one?
Yeah.
Would
so,
it be the blue one?
Okay. Yeah. So I'll make this short. I guess maybe, I don't know how many years ago this was, maybe 7 years ago, I was playing a PV. My main guitar was this PV kind of custom thing that PV gave me and had I kind of helped build, and pretty cool, like kind of a Tele, an offset Tele sort of thing. This weird thing. I don't even know the body shape went into production, but I was playing a PV, was playing a Telecaster, had played Gibsons before that, and those were kind of my main guitars. And I was at a used music shop in Sacramento called Skip's Music, and just kind of browsing around, popped in there. Maybe I was like, I don't know. I drove by and I'm like, oh, we'll go into Skip's just to see what they have. And I saw this blue sparkly Fender. Well, it was a Squire, and it was an offset guitar. And it was designed to look like an upside down Jaguar. Did I say that correct? Did I use the correct British?
Oh, that was great. That was great. That was great. No, say it American.
Well, so my friend Alan Welsh.
At the W.
Yeah, well, okay, hold on. Alan Welsh from the band Tangled Hair, he gave me a really hard time about saying Jaguar. And he roasted me for it, like, oh, mate, you say Jaguar.
Oh,
like,
my goodness.
And so I was like, I know, I got to stop saying that. And so I've tried to take on the proper British way of saying Jaguar, right? Is that how you would say it?
That's
Jaguar, yeah.
Jaguar, yeah. So, so the Supersonic was kind of allegedly modeled after seeing a picture of Hendrix playing a Jaguar upside down. And so in the mid to late 90s, one of the builders at Fender Squire was like, oh, we should do that. And that's what that guitar was. And it wasn't a very popular guitar at the time. And, you know, it kind of got probably discontinued after a year or two. And then...
Yeah, it was a year. Yeah, it ran for maybe just 1 year.
96 to 97, I think, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that is right, yeah.
And I saw this guitar at this used music shop. I think it was $700, which that's kind of a lot of money for me for a guitar. $700 or $800. Right. And I was like... What is this weird looking dumb like Squire? The sparkly blue, just dumb Squire. This thing's so dumb. I got home. I remember, like, I think I had taken a picture of it and like texted it to my girlfriend, like, can you believe this stupid guitar they have at Skips? I got home, I was just like talking about it, and I was like so pissed off about this guitar. Like, I just don't get it. Why would it be reversed like that? Like, who would want that? And then after like a day or so, I realized that like my disdain for that guitar was like kind of turning into an obsession, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I was like, I gotta get back over there. I gotta like resolve this. And so I went back to Skips a couple days later and realized, like, wait a second, I don't hate this guitar. I love this guitar. This is like everything I want in a guitar.
That is unbelievable. That's an unbelievable opening story to the fact that that guitar is almost the thing that's kind of defined Nick Reinhardt as a player.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and it, I bought it. I think I, let's see, I definitely did not have $700 or $800 at the time. So I think I maybe had to sell a couple of things, or maybe I put it on a layaway or something. But yeah, I ended up with that guitar. It was my main guitar for a really long time. And then slowly I started acquiring, I think I got the Silver Sparkle next, which it's aged, so it almost looks a little more gold sparkle. And then I was working a bass player magazine event, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, and someone brought a black Supersonic to that event, like seeing if I wanted to buy it off them. And it was,
I've only seen you use that one recently. That's been a very recent acquisition.
Yeah. So the black one is the one that I installed the GK pickup on. And that's been like, the black one has honestly been my main guitar. The most beat up, crappy Supersonic that I have is my main guitar for probably 4 or 5 years now. That one I got for cheap. Maybe that was like $300 or $400. And then, like I said, this fella in Canada wanted to help me complete my collection. So he sold me his Olympic white Supersonic. And now I have four of them. And it's silly. Like, wow, They're all the exact same guitar. Why do I have so many?
Did you not lose the original at some point?
I did not lose the original. I've definitely never misplaced or like destroyed any of these guitars. They all remain fully functional. In fact, I just had a couple, all of them needed work, and I've just recently been able to like have someone go through them and start getting them in tip top shape. But yeah, it's a great guitar. I mean, and also to anyone listening, Fender did reissue this guitar years later. I can't remember what year it was, maybe 2010, the Pawn Shop series. I can't remember what year that was when Fender reissued these, under the Fender name, and they made them in Mexico and couldn't get into them. The neck shape wasn't the same, did not feel. And I was so excited when they came out with those, like, yes, my favorite guitar. And there's going to be new ones of it and different colors. And this is so great. And they weren't as good. And I did not end up getting any of those.
Have you got a Subsonic as well?
A subsonic.
That's the Strat.
That's the baritone. It's the baritone version of the Supersonic, I think.
Is it? No. The subsonic is a Stratocaster. It was only available in graffiti yellow, and it was a baritone tuning, but unfortunately, only 27 inch, which just for me is not baritone enough. But I thought
there was a different one. Maybe I'm mistaken.
I mean, as a fella who is constantly after bass sixes, I do remember the Subsonic very well, and it was 27 inches, which is not enough to get it down into into drop E standard. But
Nick, you've also got some sort of weird like prototype, right? Did I see that a while ago? Were you talking about that before?
I think I know what you're talking about. And last year, so two NAMMs ago, Fender, is it the Alternate Reality Series? Is that what it's called?
Yep. Yeah.
They released the Powercaster.
Yes, you are playing a Powercaster at the moment. You've had a few things through Fender recently because you've been playing the their Jaguar, their player Jaguar,
the American. Somehow this is one of the biggest like marks in my timeline of being a guitar player, but somehow I got to know people at Fender, which is one of the craziest things. And like, I'm not just saying that this because you're on the line, Matt, but like Boss and Fender, the fact that I still think about this, I still go to bed like just like shaking my head in disbelief. Like, I know people at Boss and Fender, like my two favorite companies since I was a kid. Like, that is just insane to me still to think about to this day. And I don't, maybe, let's see, 4 years ago, I think, somehow I got hooked up with Fender through my friend O. Eventually, O was able to get me to someone, get my name to the right person at Fender. And Fender has been really cool to me. I got some guitars. I got to do some videos. I got some amps. And it was during their launch of the American Professional series. So my Jaguar is an American Professional, as well as my main Jazzmaster at the moment. And then I eventually did get this PowerCaster, and that's the prototype. And what makes it the prototype is that on the headstock, it does not say PowerCaster. It says Fastback, because that's what the guitar was originally called. And I think they
Oh my God, that's so cool.
I think they made like, I need to send an email and have someone find out exactly how many of these exist. I want to say there was like five, but
Fastback is such a bad name.
Well, that was copyrighted because there was some car called the Fastback. So they had to change the name at the last minute. So they changed it to PowerCaster. And when they showed me the guitar at the office, I was like, oh my God, please, if there's any way, if I could get one that says Fastback, I would love that. And they were able to get me a Fastback guitar.
Amazing.
Which is
that
amazing.
Is
pretty,
incredible.
Pretty cool.
That is incredible. What finish was that? Because the Jaguar you've got in the green.
Yeah, right? that one's in green. Man, oh wow, I'm gonna get like roasted for not knowing this. Fender is seafoam green. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Or is it surf? Is it surf green?
No. They do both colors.
They do both.
Colors
and
are,
then
are a Fender.
Okay. I wonder if this is. I believe this is proper seafoam. I get all the different like variations of seafoam, surf, aqua. Like I get those confused, especially from like different companies. But I believe that's a seafoam green with a roasted maple neck, which is really really cool.
Oh wow, it's got roasted maple neck as well.
Which I had never
board as well.
Yes,
or just neck?
Yes, neck and board, and of obviously it's a beautiful looking finish for what it is, but it also plays awesome. And I was completely unfamiliar with roasted maple until I had even seen this guitar. I was like, what is that?
Wait,
that is so
what?
Cool.
You were unfamiliar with roasted maple?
Had no idea.
That has become easily the most popular thing in the guitar world in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Honestly, we can't talk about guitars on the Guitar Nerds podcast without mentioning roasted maple anymore. It seems to be everyone's standard thing. I mean, I don't care about it, but then I don't care about any guitars made any later than 1970.
There you go.
But Matt, you love a roasted maple
guitar. I've sorted out my sort of mini studio space and recently and just playing guitar and just like I think Joe, were we talking a little bit about it on one of our podcast episodes before, where it's just like amps and pedals, you know, I've had loads, always change, but guitar, I just have to, if I play one and I just like the spec, then that's and that's always been the way. Even when I worked in guitar shops, like if you play it and you like it, just go with it. I think it's so easy to try and like pick the perfect guitar on paper and then you play it and then you're like, oh, this is terrible. Where actually half the time, if you just pick up a guitar and play it, just like, you know, that, and I guess that's what you were saying, Nick, about the kind of reissues is
yes.
You know, on paper you could go, this is exactly what I want. And then you pick it up and you're like, it just totally falls flat.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that I've noticed is, like I haven't done a whole lot of like modifying guitars or even just like customizing guitars over the years. I mean, just beyond, well, I guess that's not true. I don't know. I'm thinking back like to the early 2000s. I guess I would like tweak guitars and do this and that to them. But I guess like, for instance, when I got this American Professional, when I got the American Professional Strat and Jag, or sorry, Jazzmaster and Jag, a lot of people got those guitars at the exact same time. Like, you could throw a rock out your window and hit someone that owned the green Jag, right? And so, obviously, with all my gear and, like, kind of aesthetically, I like it to be a little different and, you know, just, like, cool and a little outside of the norm. And so, it felt like a little awkward to me. Like, oh, everyone's got this Jazzmaster right now. Dang it. So... And I liked it. It was an at-home guitar. I did some recording with it, and it was cool. And it wasn't until I was like, all right, I'm going to drop some money into this guitar, and I want to make this – I want to see if I can make this a really cool guitar, because on paper this should be great, and it is great, but it's just really not me, you know? And I switched the pickups out. I put a Mastery on there. I did the nerdy thing, and I switched the pick guard out for a tortoiseshell pick guard and rearranged some of the, like, wiring. And I tell you, that turned that guitar from just being, like, a cool at-home guitar to right now, like, my main guitar. Just through a few simple, like, not even, I don't even want to call those modifications, just, like, little upgrades, you know? And fully, like, just became this, like, really special feeling guitar to me, you know, just by doing a couple simple things.
Yeah, yeah. And the I mean, things like Mastery Bridges just, you know, definitely make a difference. But I've definitely swapped pickups out and things like that, but I've also fallen down the rabbit hole of just, like, changing everything, and then you're just like, this isn't even where I started. Right. And then you're just like, this is not even the same. I might as well have just bought another guitar at this point.
Well, that's funny. So, you know, the J. Mascus Squire Jazzmaster?
Yes.
So everyone's whole thing with that is like, well, you get that guitar and it's such a great guitar. All you have to do is throw on a Mastery and then you throw in this pickup and then it's amazing. And it's like, okay, great. You turned a $300 or $400 guitar into like $1,000 guitar. Why not? Yeah, you know, like, yeah. What are you doing? You know what I mean? So yeah, that is a kind of a funny thing. There's a fine line between, you know, yeah, like making this guitar better versus like, why don't I just buy a better guitar? You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, my goodness, we have absolutely run up at time on this podcast, and I reckon we're about 50% into.
We didn't even go into amps. I mean, you know, there's probably a whole discussion just on.
I mean, yeah, who doesn't want to talk about the time that Nick Reinhardt put a Marshall amp into a PV amp? there are so many ridiculous stories there to go into, yeah. Which means we are almost definitely going to have to do a second podcast with Nick Reinhardt. So we're going to finish up right now, but Nick, we would love you to come back and do a second podcast with me and Matt, because I feel like we've barely touched the surface. We haven't talked about all the stuff with the Fender Mustang GT. We haven't talked about your weird amp. Like, I think amplifiers for you are a whole separate subject.
Yeah, we could do. I mean, let's do this. Let's get another podcast going. We'll talk some shoe nerds at the top of it. and then we'll figure out a way to transition into amps. We could do an entire hour on amplifiers. Absolutely.
I mean, you know, for the man that put a Marshall head into a 6505, I think that is absolutely an entire podcast right there, listener. But you are going to have to wait for that, because that is about all the time we have on this Friday special. You know, thank you, Nick, for taking the time to talk to us on this podcast.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be a part of the Guitar Nerd family.
Absolutely, and you are. Listener, you can, of course, catch more Guitar Nerds over on our Patreon at patreon.com/guitarnerds, or you can join us on any social channels with @guitarnerds. And we'll be back next week on Wednesday with our regular episode, and on Friday with another Friday special. But we promise that we'll be back with another Nick Reinhardt special very soon. Thank you very much, and we'll see you later for more of this Guitar Nerdery. Farewell.
See ya.